The Baker Street Babes are pleased to announce the return of our annual charity ball, the Daintiest Thing in a Dressing Gown Pajama Party. Yes, that's right, a pajama party. Join a onesie-clad Arthur Conan Doyle and come in your finest Deerstalker jammies, dressing gowns, onesies, and fluffy stash slippers. This is open to all Sherlockians and their friends. The event includes a buffet dinner, cash bar, live music, fantastic prizes, and delightful entertainment. Hosted by William Gillette, the charity ball will once again take place at the Players Club, Thursday, January 14th at 8 p.m. Tickets for the event are available at daintiestpjparty.brownpapertickets.com. 100% of the proceeds will benefit the Disabled American Veterans Trust. They strive to provide physical and psychological support programs for the wounded and disabled veterans and their families. We are requesting if any of you fine citizens of the internet are inclined to clean out any Sherlockian-oriented closets or donate original pieces of art and crafts, we'd be thrilled and honored to accept the donations for our live and silent auctions. Shipping becomes very difficult during the holiday season, so if anyone has an item to contribute or a suggestion to make, we are all ears, and we'll promptly give you our mailing address or collect the object at a Sherlockian event in the NYC area.
The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to read new and exciting writings by Sherlockians, or even find information on how to get published in the journal, please visit their website, www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gasogene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, a new generation on Sherlock's Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street Babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2-2-1?
Okay, thank you to Ken Ludwig for being here on our latest Baker Street Babes podcast. You are listening to myself, Lindsay Fay, and you are also listening to Dr. Ashley Polishek.
Hello.
Huzzah! Ken is coming to us from, are you in Philadelphia, Ken, or where are you at right now?
No, I'm in Washington, D.C. at the moment.
You're at your place. Okay.
I am. Uh-huh.
Fantastic. Ken, we're very, very excited for this interview.
I'm excited to be here, let me add.
that is the best possible response that we could get from any guest. So thank you so much. He is probably known to many of the people who play the grand game as the playwright of The Games Afoot. So The Games Afoot actually was starring William Gillette. This was a wonderful play that takes place at the Gillette Castle and won an Edgar Award in the year 2012, I believe it was.
That's
but
right.
Ken, yeah, that must have been so exciting.
It was. It really was, yeah.
Yay! So that was your first Sherlockian venture, is that right, when it comes to playwriting?
It was. Let me add just for the fun of it that the big award ceremony for the Edgar Awards was at the Waldorf Astoria, and it's in the ballroom with about, 500 people, and there's dinner, and there's one award after another, and it's really great because the Mystery Writers of America just love, putting on this big event every year, and it was super fun.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Can I tell you a secret?
Right.
I'm on the national board for the Mystery Writers of America, so I'm gonna tell them that you had a good time.
Oh, cool. They did a wonderful job. Oh my God, I loved it.
Oh, all right. I'm so happy about that. So you have had also 6 shows on Broadway and 6 in the West End, and that includes iconic shows like Lend Me a Tenor, Moon Over Buffalo. You have done some amazing work in the theater, and I used to be actually a professional actor, and Ashley is a student of not only Sherlockian film, in which she has her doctorate, but also of Sherlock Holmes on stage. So we're really happy to talk to you today.
Oh, cool.
And also, yay, where I live in upstate South Carolina, your plays are extremely popular. I think in the last year we've put on Lend Me a Tenor, Moon Over Buffalo, Leading Ladies, and Fox in the Fairway. So,
oh, how great.
We're on a roll.
Thrilling. Well, thank you for saying that.
Ken, it's like a festival. You could just head down there.
Okay.
So we are going to ask Ken 4 questions, after which he will be an honorary Baker Street babe.
I'm excited.
Not as excited as we are, I promise. So the first question, and these are all these are all difficult questions, to be frank with you, but I think that you're going to handle them with aplomb. So first of all, how were you introduced initially to Sherlock Holmes? Was it through an adaptation? Was it through the canon? How did you come to it?
It really came to me through my mother. She was a great one for mysteries. In fact, recently my brother was cleaning out his attic, I mean, just a week ago, and they brought over a whole bunch of boxes filled with my mom's books, and they were these mysteries that are in a series. There were like 4 mysteries to a book, and she signed her name at the front of each of them, and she was a great lover of mystery stories, and she also was an actress in her day, and she introduced me to mysteries as a genre, and really created my love for mysteries. And of course, top of the list was Sherlock Holmes in everybody's list. And so I've loved Holmes since I was, you know, in my 5, 6, 7, 8 years old when she told me the stories, and then when I started reading them in my young teens, I got hooked.
Baby Sherlock fans are the best.
Baby Sherlock.
I was 5-year-old Ken.
Dear stalker, you have no idea.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You'd be surprised.
starting from childhood, you have a lot of characters to choose from, and your inclinations this way may have changed as you have grown up, but who is your favorite character from the Sherlock Holmes mystery?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one.
You said isn't that awful?
It should be tough. Well, it's like if you say, what are your favorite plays? What do you think of the best plays in the world? I was asked over a dinner table recently. You sort of have to put Hamlet aside because, you know, sure, it is
right.
The greatest play ever written. So who is the greatest character? Well, Holmes and Watson, of course. But taking Holmes and Watson aside, because they're everybody's favorite and they are the greatest of the great and they're the best of the best, I'd say, even though we don't ever get to see much of him, is Sherlock's brother.
Mm.
Good choice.
I love him. Yeah, he's so interesting, and it's so tantalizing, and you don't get much of him in the stories. How many stories does he appear in? You guys would know better than I do.
Just 2.
Just 2? Yeah, mm-hmm. But he's become part of the canon. I mean, Mycroft is so distinctive. It was such a brilliant creation.
He's wonderful.
Is it the Diogenes Club, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, what an also a brilliant idea. So I love him.
Did you pick up a copy of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's Mycroft Holmes pastiche he just put out?
No, I haven't yet. I saw that it was out, and I'm so inundated with all the books I'm reading at the moment.
Oh, sure.
It's on my Christmas list.
It's good. It's good. We recommend it.
Is it? Oh, good.
Yeah, very well researched and all of that. Okay, so this question is going to be a little bit tricky for you. On stage or screen, big or small, or radio, doesn't matter, which adaptation of Sherlock Holmes is your favorite? And if you want to say one of yours, we won't judge.
Absolutely, Baskerville, without a doubt. I'd be crazy not to say it. Come on, Baskerville. It's a play I just wrote.
Hands down.
It's being done at the Philadelphia Theater Company. It was done last year at the McCarter and its arena, and I had a whopping time writing it. If I had to go to other plays, if you forced me to
inferior one,
plays, and putting aside the Games of Foot, which is Sherlockian because it's about William Gillette, but it's not about Holmes himself. I would say really the original, the William Gillette play, Sherlock Holmes, because I got to see it when I was tiny. My parents mm-hmm. brought me to Washington, D.C., and it was on tour, the great production that the Royal Shakespeare Company did that brought it to light all over again in the late 70s, early 80s, and with John Wood starring as Sherlock Holmes, and what was his name who played Moriarty? Philip. Oh, great actor. But, you know, when the Royal Shakespeare Company did it upright with all four, is it four sets?
I've heard nothing but great feedback about that production from people who got to see it.
It was magically good. It was just great. It was so exciting and so much fun, and it really revived the whole genre as far as I was concerned. But, yeah, I was tiny when I saw it, but I've since, you know, read about it, and I have pretty vivid memories of it. I remember it being just really, you sat on the edge of your seat. It was great.
Oh, that's wonderful. So one more then, and this is a different question from who is your favorite canonical character. Of all the fascinating people in the Sherlock Holmes canon, who would you most like to sit down over tea or a whiskey and pick their brain?
Well, I suppose, let me think about this. I hope it's not a cop-out. Well, I don't know if he'd talk to me, but I'd say Sherlock himself.
Oh, that's hand, great.
You'd get a great view of him through Mycroft. You'd get a marvelous view of him through Watson. But, of course, we've gotten our view of him through Watson. So I don't know that I'd have, you know, he'd have millions of things to tell me. But if Sherlock would deign to spend an hour with me, even if he just smoked across the room, I'd be happy.
I think that's brilliant because we always get our vision of him filtered almost always, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and even when he takes it upon himself to write the two canonical cases that, you know, he sits down and he says, all right, I'm going to try it myself, he admits that it's much more difficult than he thought it was, but even he's censoring himself for the Strand magazine when he's sitting down to write that. So every time we see Sherlock Holmes, it's filtered somehow.
Way to play the game, Lindsay.
Absolutely right. Not unlike Jeeves and Wooster. I don't know if you all are people.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, of course, Jeeves narrates one of those stories himself.
Yes, it's very bizarre.
And it's not as telling, you know, it's not as revealing as you would think. It's if anything, it's a little stilted.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, you are now officially an honorary Baker Street babe, Ken.
Oh, man, that's so fantastic. Do I get to wear anything special?
Yes. Absolutely. Whatever you please. I mean, a dainty bonnet would be appropriate. Any number of things. You're completely free to costume as you see fit.
This is going to go in my biography, you know, my official biography. This is definitely, you know.
We'll right next to the Tony.
We'll be checking.
For sure.
All right, folks. Now it's Ken, Tony Award winner, and Baker Street Babe, honorary Baker Street Babe.
Yes.
Awesome. There well, there's a little bit of housekeeping I have to take care of because when I asked the internet what we should chat with you about, any questions, immediately a bunch of people said that they wanted to say hi. So, so the misfits over at I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Scott Monty and Bert Wolder, would like to say hi.
Okay.
And would like to say that they think that you probably had a better time on their podcast. That's
they're wrong. They're wrong.
We're going to get you at some point to just say the Baker Street Babes are a better podcast than I hear. No, we won't. They are lovely gentlemen.
The Baker Street Babes are the better podcast.
Oh, my God. We win.
Eat that, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Suck it, Wolder. Oh, you just made our day. And Bob Katz, Robert Katz, apparently went to school with you.
Yes, we were in Haverford together. I love Bob. Oh, my gosh.
Gotta love some Bob Katz.
Yeah,
well, there you are.
Great. He's great.
Oh, he's just lovely. I was telling a story about him to David Stewart Davies one day, who is not unknown in the theater world either.
Sure.
Over there. And David's so funny, but I was telling him about, you know, this thing Bob Katz did, and he stopped me. He's like, Lindsay, Bob Katz? Bob Katz? Lindsay, why? What are you telling me about Bob Katz? I'm like, David, Robert Katz. And he's like, oh.
You know, Bob gets his interest in Sherlock Holmes very honestly. I don't know if it preceded Haverford, which is, you know, the college where he and I both went to, but Haverford College is also known for an alum, Christopher Morley.
Aha. Uh-huh.
who, of course, has very strong ties to Sherlock Holmes. And I don't know if that's where Bob first got his interest in Holmes or not. I just don't know.
We'll have to have him on the podcast.
I'm not sure I'd say Bob comes by anything terribly honestly. Let's be honest. Rogue and a scoundrel, like all Sherlockians.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I am very excited to have the opportunity to see Baskerville, and our fearless leader, Christina Menenti, has seen it. But unfortunately, she is unable to be on the podcast today, although she did send us one or two comments and questions. But Ashley has the script. So would you like to – the show, of course, has already played in both D.C. and New Jersey. Is that true?
Yes, it's played at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., and it played at the McCarter Theater in Princeton. And it also played at the Old Globe in San Diego for a long run. It was extended three times. And so it's played there. And it's just about to be released to the there's a production coming up at the Seattle Rep. And it's just about to be released by the publisher, licensor Samuel French, into the world. And I know they have a whole bunch of new productions coming up on the release date, which is like any minute now, maybe today or yesterday or whatever it was.
Congrats.
Thanks.
Perfect.
Yay.
So then we can all see it, and our listeners can all see it, too.
Over the place, I hope.
But since probably the majority of our listeners haven't seen it, can you tell us just a little bit about it? Because obviously it has an unusual conceit. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. What I did when I was, you know, I'm a professional playwright, and what I do is I, you know, write plays day in and day out. I want to often in production and sometimes directing them myself, but by and large, most of my time is spent actually sitting by myself in my study writing plays. And I had finished a certain play, I forget which one it was. It was after the Games of Foot. It was maybe after Fox and the Fairway. And I didn't know what I'd write next. And I went to my library shelves, as I often do, How to the Baskervilles, it was sort of a jog, and I pulled it out and thought, I haven't read this in a while. And I reread it, and I realized anew, I don't think I'd ever forgotten it, is that it is certainly one of the two or three greatest adventure stories ever written, in my view, you know, along with Treasure Island and what else would qualify in that, maybe The Prisoner of Zenda. And I thought, wouldn't this be fun to dramatize? So I sat down and thought about it, and I thought, well, there's two ways I could do it. One way would be to do it with a cast of 12 or 15, and then there'd be some little bit of doubling along the way. But in a more traditional way, that I wrote did an adaptation for in England and Bristol for the Bristol Old Vic of Treasure Island, and there I did indeed use 12 or 15 actors. But then I thought, well, maybe something more fun would be to try to do this with as few actors as possible, because it would do sort of two things. It would actually, on a practical level, make it more producible. Theaters all over the country really don't want 12 actors or 15 actors.
Sure.
Actors are expensive, and the clear trend in this country, and probably worldwide, is the fewer actors the better, because theater is becoming more and more expensive to produce. So few actors, good thing for a playwright. But more than that, I thought it would be fun if it was very few actors in the sort of the tradition we've seen lately in the 39 Steps, but it's an age-old tradition that's been around forever. There was a play in the West End maybe 15 years ago called Stones in His Pockets, set in Ireland during the filming of a movie in this little town of Ireland, and there were two actors playing all the different characters. So it's done all the time, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to do that, because it would be innately theatrical. It would do what I hope my plays do, or what I try to do in my plays, which is to create a sense of the theatrical moment at the same time I'm telling the story. So that when you're in one of my plays, you not only get involved in the story, but you say, I'm in the theater. Every minute you're there, you're partaking of a theatrical event. And so what I did was I wrote Hound of the Baskervilles with five actors. One actor plays Holmes, one plays Watson, and the other three play all the other 40-some characters in the story. The woman has maybe the most of those roles, I think. Maybe she does about eight. Well, I don't even want to say. Maybe 16 different actors, but different characters. But they all play a lot, and they're changing costume a lot. But I didn't want it to become a costume parade or just about how fast they could change costumes. Though the magic of that is fun, and turned out to be lots of fun for the audience, because the audience, members of the audience during all the versions I've seen, where the audience came out afterwards and said, "Well, when it came time for the curtain call, where are all the other actors?" So there is a lot. There's a magic trick to that, and it's lots of fun to do that. But I went in thinking, no, everybody's going to know it's these three actors playing these 40-some characters, and isn't that fun to see them, even if it's just putting on a different hat, isn't it fun to see them transform themselves? And when I directed the very first production, I directed myself at the Kennedy Center. I do that with virtually all my plays, because I live in D.C. and I have had a great relationship with them forever, and we get about 400 or 500 people in the theater, I have a short rehearsal time, and it's a reading, it's a glorified reading at music stands, and in a way that's always the most fun, and in this case was maybe the most fun this play has ever been, because there was no pretending they went out and changed. They literally put on different hats, stood up, and used different accents, and became these other characters. And the story was clear as a bell. And that's a long answer, but it really, what the play is meant to feel and be about the theatrical experience.
It seems to me a very apt answer, though, because it kind of leads me into something I was curious about when it comes to adapting Hound. And to adapting any classic mystery play, as a matter of fact, if you're going to put on Baskerville, or if you're going to write a similar show, or even if you're going to just put on 10 Little Indians, which has played a cajillion bajillion times worldwide, how do you maintain that aura of suspense and fear and audience investment when everybody really knows what's about to happen next? Mm-hmm. I mean, people are familiar with the story of the Hound of the Baskervilles, and the hound itself doesn't show up until, you know, the tail end of the production. So for you to say that it's all about the actors makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, I think you're exactly right. It's a way, by doing it in a new way, it adds a sense of danger and originality and joy and adventure and fun, and that's what the theater's about, and that's what that story is about.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way to make the play new again.
Mm-hmm. That's what I tried to do.
So it sounds like you picked Hound because it was the one on your bookshelf. Did you ever consider, I'll do a different Sherlock Holmes story?
This is a question that we were asked online, too, actually, whether there were other, in addition to Hound of the Baskervilles, ones that you might have considered because you thought that one of the characters deserved more of a backstory or was intriguing, that sort of thing.
I did. Once I pulled Hound off the shelf because it happened to be sticking out a little bit because I think my son had reread it recently, but it was amid all my other Sherlock Holmes stories. So when I pulled it out and read it and loved it so much, first thing I did was second-guess myself a little bit and go, now let me reread the others. Maybe there is an even better one to do. I think it turned out for me to be the best one because it's certainly my favorite of all the stories. It has the most whopping story. It moves like a play or a movie. It's innately so dramatic. You know, if you take something like, say, I'm just picking out of the hat, say the Copper Beaches or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the trouble is when you're in the world of the short stories, they're just too short for an evening.
Right.
You'd have to try to then combine two or three of them. That wouldn't really be true to the work because that's not how he conceived them. He conceived them as these perfect little stories. They're perfect for television adaptations, for example, because of the length.
I always call them little jewel boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but too small for the scope of of most stage and most film, which leads to all sorts of interesting trouble. To be honest, the same difficulty presents itself when I'm guilty of a novel-length Sherlock Holmes pastiche from Simon & Schuster, and the same thing happens because he works so well in short story form that in order to drag it out for as long as you need for a novel, effectively, even Conan Doyle says, well, Holmes, you go away for half of it. You know?
That's right.
In all of them, essentially.
Yes, I know. Yep. And I got a lot of comments about that during Baskerville. They said, why did you get rid of Holmes? Well, the story dictates it.
I didn't.
Yeah, I didn't, exactly.
Well, it dictates it because you can't be allowed to solve something that quickly because it's supposed to be a novel. You know?
That's right. And also, I think Conan Doyle did it, you know, such a genius, and he did it probably instinctively. I don't know if he thought it through, but he probably did because, like all real geniuses, they do think these things through. They just make it look like they don't. Is that he, you know, Sherlock Holmes is such a powerful character that using him a little more sparingly makes him even better, I think. And so I think he just did that in virtually all the novels. And interesting, one of my favorite pastiches is Beekeeper's Apprentice.
The Mary Russell one by Laurie King.
Yeah, the Laurie King one, the first Laurie King one.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
And again, I think is very smart on her part is that she uses him a little more sparingly. It really focuses on Mary Russell.
Exactly.
That's what makes those novels work, I think.
Yeah.
They're excellent. Once you've, you know, sort of put some of your ducks in a row and you say to yourself, okay, this is how I want to write the adaptation, and you've gone through your draft work and you've, you know, had some time to read it out loud, to really, you know, make it a taut and cohesive piece. I, quite frankly, would be ridiculously intimidated by the prospect of casting Sherlock Holmes. and it is never easy to cast Sherlock Holmes, but if you're doing a classic Victorian Sherlock Holmes, In that instance, unlike, say, for instance, Elementary or BBC Sherlock, you also have to find somebody who not only has, you know, the 10-mile genius eyeball, but you also have to find somebody who has great chemistry with Watson, who, you know, is capable of doing a period piece. Were you intimidated at all when you were going into this project by the fact that it was going to be period, that, you know, some of these roles are in fact very, very difficult to get right?
I wasn't intimidated so much as I was stoked. I thought it would be fun going. It's always hard to cast a play. Casting is everything. I just had a play past year. I've been deeply involved in a new play, which is a sequel to Lend Me a Tenor called A Comedy of Tenors, that just had its big initial run. And for me, the characters of Max and Saunders are sort of iconic because I created them years and years ago and Lend Me a Tenor.
Yeah.
It was more of a challenge than a worry. And in the case of Sherlock Holmes, I did go in knowing one thing. I wanted to keep Holmes and Watson young. Maybe it was the influence of seeing how fantastic they are in Sherlock by using, Cumberbatch and... Freeman, right?
Freeman, yeah.
Yeah. It made them sort of feel vital. I learned that early on from a wonderful director who did one of my first Broadway shows who said, look, always cast younger than people would expect you to. It always adds a little vitality and oomph to the production, and I think it's true. So, for example, when we cast this first world premiere production, Holmes is played, if you go to my website, just kenludwig.com, or if you go to, I don't know if Arena or McCarter still have it on their website, but just go to mine. It was cast, you see the pictures, is Greg Waddell. Greg Waddell is about the handsomest guy I ever saw in my life. And he's full of beans, and he's about, 38 years old, and he had a Watson at the same age, and he was great, and that very sparky vitality, I think, was a big plus in making the show work so well in its world premiere. It just soared because they were so full of energy. So for me, it was not. I knew I didn't want to go and cast a modern version of Basil Rathbone, though I adore Basil Rathbone. I have a book signed by Basil Rathbone. He's my favorite. But that's not the direction I wanted to go with that. I just don't think that's quite right for where we are. And, of course, the recent movies have a very young Sherlock Holmes, too, and Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Haven't we, Ashley, talked before about, you know, every era gets the Holmes they deserve?
Yeah, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. I think we've certainly moved into a sort of a period where we need a less patriarchal Holmes. So having somebody who's more like a, you know, kind of a wunderkind rather than somebody who has to be, you know, the solid sort of epitome of capability.
Right.
Somebody who's able to kind of get things wrong and then, but is so energetic he can just sort of bluster over it. That seems to a little bit be more the hero that we go for right now. So going young certainly works there.
Yeah, that was exactly my thought.
There was one question regarding the actual staging of the production that Christina was commenting on, and I did not understand what she was saying when she
wrote it. I didn't understand it either.
Are there magnetic flowers in Baskerville?
Yeah, there are.
Can you talk about them for a second?
Because
apparently they're really awesome. And Chris was curious. She said she thought she loved them. She thought they were great. And she was curious whether you were going for an atmosphere of whimsy or storytelling when you were using them. And I am just absolutely...
we're baffled.
We're really baffled. So,
I will now enlighten you. They are completely the creation of the set designer, Dan Osling. Dan is a great American set designer. He did the famous Metamorphosis is still being done all over the country. He's really major, major Tony-winning set designer. And as we did it, Amanda Dennert, who directed this first world premiere production, wanted to stage the play, and she had a very specific way she wanted to stage the play, which was using lots of drops, lots of things from above, and lots of things from below. So it has tons of trapdoors in it, this particular production. And it's the one that's about to be reproduced, and Amanda is redirecting at Philadelphia Stage Company. It's going to be done in a few other places, too. It was such a sort of definitive, interesting staging that it's being done in a lot of places with the permission of the McCarter Theater and Arena Stage. And it's the same set going around the country and so on. It was so interesting and definitive. Now, for example, San Diego at the Old Globe, one of the great theaters of America, did not use that staging. So the idea is, you take, just like all plays, you license it from Samuel French and you put on your own production. But and 99 times out of 100, they're not going to use magnetized flowers.
I mean, it's not exactly a trope that we've seen sweep the nation.
That's right. But it was so cool. It was so cool, and it's about to be reproduced, and it's being done. I talked to Amanda the other day. They're doing it in Philly right this minute. And what the idea was, the scenes are changing so quickly because, as you can see, the piece moves rather quickly, and you've got to go right from Baskerville. You know, in this case, you go right from Baskerville, the home Baskerville, out into the moor. And in the moor, it goes right into this scene where, first of all, this is the murky moor, but this scene that it goes to is the one where Stapleton meets Miss Stapleton meets Sir Henry, and they fall in love. And so we wanted that to be a brightly sunlit, I wanted it to be, at least I put it in my stage direction, a brightly sunlit area of the moors, not the murky part. So Osling and his genius thought, well, how do I make that transition quickly? So from above, from the... up in the flies, he had on a timer, a push-button timer, and they were timed individually, these about 30 flowers, these real tall flowers with gorgeous blooms on them that come down as if they're going to kill somebody in the down below because they're all magnetized, and they come down as these noisy bang, 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 and hit the deck and are all standing up straight. And it's part of what creates the bright, sunny moment on the moor. And the
audience, that's lovely.
Love it.
Yeah, and it plays right into what you were talking about with the hyper-theatricalized sense where people are really walking into the theater with a tacit expectation that, you know, this is the fourth wall, I'm suspending my disbelief, I am going to be told a story, and now, you know, boom, flowers.
Exactly.
You're welcome.
Exactly.
Yeah, you've written wonderful directions in there that have the actors sort of being aware in much the same way that the players are in 39 Steps, that they seem to be a little bit aware sometimes that they're in a play. So Watson, when there's a non-diegetic sound cue every time Grimp and Meyer is stated,
right,
he starts to get frustrated, and then he starts avoiding saying Grimp and Meyer because he doesn't
exactly
want the sound cue to come
exactly
on. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, that's the fun of theater. You know, if you're in theaters, get to do things in theater you don't do in the movies. And that's exactly why. I'll tell you a funny story about the flowers. The footnote about the flowers is, this original production was a co-production of Arena Stage and MacArthur Theater. At Arena, it was in the Krieger. There's three theaters at Arena Stage. It's in the Krieger, which is the proscenium theater, and the proscenium is not that high. It's just a sort of normal proscenium. So the flowers had to drop, somebody stands up, they're 6 feet tall, 6'12". Maybe they were dropping 20 feet because if from the top of the proscenium from the flies down to the floor was maybe 20, 22 feet. So they, like bullets, they'd land right on the floor, bang, 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 bang. At the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, the theater is much bigger. It's 1,100 seats. The Krieger was 500. It's about 1,100 seats. It's this vast theater and has a big, huge proscenium opening. And so they had to fly down more like 30 or 35 feet from the And the trouble was what Dan had not counted on is that anything that high encounters wind currents.
Yep.
So the flowers
go on.
wouldn't land with that absolute same snap and loud noise they would. So he had to retinker with them and make them heavier and rebuild them and make them slightly bigger. And so it was they had their own drama. There was the drama of the flowers.
Well, at least they didn't sort of lift to starboard and land on an actor's head. I mean, it could have been worse.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that you, in some sense, it could be argued that you're channeling Doyle a bit when you have this awareness of the fact that the actors are, you know, presenting a Sherlockian play. Because in the original Strand magazine, Sherlock Holmes and John Watson, they're well aware of the fact they're published in the Strand, and Sherlock Holmes, you know, wastes no opportunity to tease Watson about the fact that he's writing all these ridiculous stories for the Strand magazine. So you've got this extra layer of meta that's already built into the canon.
Yes. Isn't that brilliant of him? That's like the most brilliant touch. Yeah, I thought they did that really nicely in this new movie with the McKellen one we were talking about, Holmes. Yeah.
So when he goes to see himself in the movie theater?
Yeah.
There are so many layers there because the version of himself is played by Nicholas Rowe, who played Sherlock in Young Sherlock Holmes. So it's McKellen as Holmes in Mr. Holmes watching a fake Holmes play a fake version of the Holmes he played. In
Isn't
another
that
home.
Amazing?
It's just
it's so great.
It's wild.
Wild.
My brain hurts. I think you broke it.
Yeah. Well, sorry. And by sorry, I mean sorry.
Sorry.
There is one other thing that I would be remiss if I didn't bring up, and that is that your love of opera has leaked in again, and we have a sort of Tosca.
Right.
That seems to stop the action. But did you just feel like I just need to have Tosca in here. I can't live without it.
Well, I like the idea of course, the going to the opera doesn't exist in Hound of the Baskervilles at all. And I do it twice. I do it at that moment, the Tosca moment, and I do it at the end and take them off to see Falstaff to end the whole play. And I just love opera, and I thought Weirwell would be a great place for Holmes to think. And one of the fun parts for me was to, as I'd have Watson speak, have his bits of narration try to sound like Doyle, but of course our ersatz Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, taking him to the opera, that's a moment when Watson has a longish speech about Holmes, you know, thinking things through like a ciphering machine, even though down below another murder is going on right in front of our eyes, the murder of Baron Scarpia by Tosca. Mm-hmm. And I got a kick out of that. And I also, my favorite obsession, of course, is Shakespeare. I put Shakespeare into all my plays, and I've written a book recently about Shakespeare, and it's always been my lifelong love. And I have some Shakespeare dotted through Baskerville as well.
Oh, Doyle had that all over the pre-return canon. It doesn't happen so much after he dies and comes back, but, you know, Holmes is quoting... Well, actually, no, he does still continue to quote Shakespeare, just not foreign languages quite so much. But, yeah, when you hide those little nuggets...
Right. Your theater lovers are going to... They love the intertextual comments there. It's always fun.
Love hiding stuff like that. It's very interesting. In this latest play I did, Comedy of Tenors, a scarf is what causes the huge jealousy in the play. And I don't read reviews, but I talked to all my friends who did, and we got, knock wood, uniformly great reviews. But nobody noticed the Othello reference.
I was going to say, I mean, that's
really
straight up Cassius.
Well, oh God, theater critics, what are you going to do?
Yeah, right.
I just looked it up, and you're spot on, because I forgot what opera it is, but they do go to the opera, Holmes and Watson, at the end of Hound.
Mm.
And it's Les Huguenots.
My
French is a little rusty.
Oh, do they?
They go to Les Huguenots at the end of, I hope I'm saying that right, and they're going to see the Desresques perform it. That's the last line, and he says, might I trouble you to be ready in half an hour, and we can stop at Marcini's for a little dinner on the way.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's where I got the idea then.
There you go.
Do you find that happens to you, where something that, if you're studying a text like you were obviously studying Hound of the Baskervilles in order to adapt it, some of it just gets lodged in there by osmosis, right? Do you ever notice that you've put intertextual things in that you really had no notion that you'd done until later, and someone's pointed it out to you?
Absolutely. All the time. Maybe just a sheer function of getting old and doddery. And I do. Yep. All the time.
I think that is probably quite common for anybody who's taking a text and then, you know, moving it into an adaptation of another one.
Yeah, because, you know, playwriting is so instinctive. I mean, all writing is, and I try to emphasize that whenever I lecture to people and stuff and say, you know, read, you know, how to be a writer. Well, read, think, but read even more, and then just go write. And your instincts take over, and those instincts are often reacting to things that are hidden back in your brain that you don't know why and where they come from. I had no idea. I couldn't have told you in a million years they go back to Les Huguenots. But there you go.
It was
in there
somewhere.
The edge of my brain. I was like, which opera do they go to? I know they go to the opera at the end of Hound, but yeah. No, that's funny. I find that, you know, having also swam around in the theatrical pond for such a long time that when I sit down to write a novel, I can't write it in anything other than straight up three act structure. Like, it's completely impossible for me. Mm. I've tried even not to.
I think that structure is hidden in our DNA. There's something about that structure that is innately right to us for literary creation. I know just what you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't shake it. Is there anything that you can tell us about any future productions of Baskerville or Sherlockian projects that you are working on, or opportunities to see you talk about playwriting or about Sherlock Holmes, et cetera? Anything coming up for you on the calendar that we can tell everybody about and then just, you know, swamp you and buy you drinks?
I'd love it. They're about. I'm not keeping a secret because I just don't know it. I don't keep it up to myself. But Simon French is about to release, or maybe it's even already on their website. Who's next going to do the play, Baskerville? And I would imagine it's going to be all over the place, and the worldwide rights have been released. So their website may say where it's coming up next. It may be already on there. Games of Foot is done all over the all over the place, especially during the coming Christmas season, because I said it during Christmas. It's about William Gillette, but its subtitle is Homes for the Holidays. A little silly.
Ashley has a story to tell you about William Gillette.
Oh, good. Tell me.
Well, it's very brief, but I got married in August at exactly. Gillette Castle. That was
my
wedding. So.
Oh,
and
how cool.
Tyke and Teddy Niver, who portray Will and Helen Gillette at the castle for visitors, they turned up at the end of my wedding in full Holmesian gear. And
how cool!
So that was fun. So if you're going to be a nerd, you might as well be a huge, huge nerd. That's my
how
philosophy.
How cool is that? Oh man.
I told her that the Jeremy Brett theme played during my candle lighting ceremony at my wedding, so.
Cool.
Nerds.
Oh, how cool.
So that one is often, you said, played during the holidays.
I get Google alerts about, you know, I stick Google alerts, and I've seen that Games Afoot is going on in almost be three dozen places in the coming
Great.
Months. Three, four dozen places all over the United States.
Actually, probably somewhere near you.
Probably. It won't be long before we put that one up, and we'll put them all up. My husband is an actor, and he directs as well, so
cool.
I'm sure he'll jump on them.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
Are you working on any other is there anything Sherlockian that could potentially tickle your fancy, having done a couple that were so, you know, obviously it was a joy for you because you love the original stories, but they've been very, very excellently well received by the Sherlockian community at large and the theater-going community who, you know, maybe they like Sherlock Holmes, maybe they have seen, you know, BBC Sherlock or Robert Downey Jr., but might not have been familiar otherwise and loved it too. So do you think you might take a stab at it again?
I think I might. I absolutely might. It's so attractive. I don't know what I'm going to write. I'm finishing up a new play right now, and I've been thinking about what to do next. And is there a sequel to be done? I don't think there's a sequel to be done to Hound of the Baskervilles. It would be, sort of creepy to do it. I mean, it's just not right. I mean, the canon is a bit sacred, and you don't want to go too far afield, I think. But it would be fun to look at one of the other novels. It would be fun to think about putting maybe some of the short stories together. I have no plans right now to do that. I've recently been asked by the estate of a major mystery writer to take one of her novels and put it on stage, and I've written that.
Awesome.
And that's coming up next year. That's already.
Fantastic.
It's about to be, news of it's about to be released. And so I've
Great.
Just done another mystery, and it's been exciting, really exciting to do. I've written this other play since, a play I'm working on now that I can tell you about called The Gods of Comedy. About halfway through writing it. And I have a new show
awesome.
Opening in London where I've done the first, we did a first big reading of a new musical based on fantastic Fred Astaire, Judy Garland movie, Easter Parade.
Yay!
Stage version of it that we did a big reading in London last year. We'll be doing a reading again soon, and that's going to be heading to the West End. It's exciting. And
congrats again.
Thank you.
You must be so tired.
No, I love what I do so much.
It's just amazing that you can be that prolific and you just flow with ideas. And just
I would love to see you tackle a Sherlockian comedy of some sort, like a company of actors who are putting on the Gillette production and everything goes wrong.
That's a funny idea.
Yep.
Yeah, like add another even layer of meta on the meta. So it's like meta tone. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a wonderful play I saw recently in the West End that was called The Play That Goes Wrong, and it was
they were
trying to put the play on.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
How was
fantastic.
It
was hilarious. I wet myself. It was great.
Very funny.
You can tell from the damp skirt that it was a good show.
Yeah, correct. Correct.
Yeah.
Well, I nominate Ken to be in charge of the Sherlockian version of Noises Off.
Oh, good. You got it.
Seconded.
I'm in.
Seconded.
I'm in.
Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about how people can, are you on Twitter, or do you have a website that people can visit if
website.
They want to know?
I have a website. Please come to the website. It's kenludwig.com. Twitter, I am. I'd love to get more Twitter followers. It is ken_Ludwig. I do have Facebook. I'd love, if I'm allowed to put in plugs, I'd love people to buy my book. I had a book published 2 years ago by Random House about Shakespeare called How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare.
Yes.
And last year it won the Falstaff Award as the best Shakespeare book of 2014.
Outstanding.
So it's really dear to my heart because I love Shakespeare so much. And it teaches, it's really for adults as well. Anybody who's frightened of Shakespeare, which is 99.9% of the population of the world, of the English-speaking world, and think it's mysterious and difficult to read, this book says to adults, and then you adults can then teach your children, is that it's not. And it's not difficult. What you do is you just learn it. You learn the word, what the words mean, and then you memorize little portions of it. And what I do in the book is I have 25 passages that you memorize yourself and then help your children memorize those short little passages and then explain the plays they're from and tell about the plays, a little about his life. And it has, if you go to the Random House's website for it, which is howtoteachyourchildrenshakespeare.com, I'll do some name dropping here. I called my dear friend Derek Jacobi up and asked him if he would read.
That'll do as a name, Jack. That'll
yes,
very
good.
That'll do.
I felt the vibration from that.
If he would do me a favor and read the passages, record them for the book, so that anyone wanting to learn the passages could hear him reciting them. And he brought in two friends of his, Richard Clifford and Francis Barber, the great who just did the great Cleopatra in London, and so fantastic. And they read the passages from the book. And so you can just go to howtoteachyourchildrenshakespeare.com. You don't even have to buy the book to do this. It's just go and listen to them do these glorious passages from Shakespeare.
But everybody should buy the book.
Everybody should buy the book. I hope you do.
Yeah.
That sounds fabulous.
Absolutely,
awesome.
And we've now kept you much longer than we said we would because
yeah, we lied.
You're too interesting for your own good. It's your
fault.
Well,
what a pleasure. You guys are great. You guys are great. Boy, I'd love to meet.
Oh, we'd love to meet you too. We'll cross our fingers and hope that that at some time maybe you could come to the Baker Street Regulars weekend here in New York when we're all here together.
Oh, I would just love to. I would love to. And if you're ever
we'll let everybody people, know that you would love to.
Yeah. Oh, good.
We'll make sure they know.
Great.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast, and congratulations not only on all of your more minor accomplishments, but now on being an honorary Baker Street babe.
Yay. Yes, I'm telling you, honest to goodness, that's going into my permanent theater biography on every playbill ever. You're stuck with me. Too late. Can't get out of it.
Oh, I love it. Right. Oh, thank you so much. And,
well, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and we hope to see you in person sometime soon.
Same here. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ken.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. What a cutie.
Right?
Oh, my God.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you?